So, number one, huh?
So they tell me.
I guess you're a real celebrity down in Orion, Maryland, huh?
Nah. Same old guy.
Still selling the insurance?
One day a week.
One day? Why do you push yourself so hard?
Why do I push myself so hard? 41?
Mm-hmm.
Because I like writing. It's the most fun I've ever had at anything. You can build your own little world, and like a kid with his toy trains, except instead of trains, I have tanks and ships and airplanes and things. And I get to make them do all the things I want them to do. If I don't like the way it works out, I start again.
Well, the hunt for Red October was really an impetus too, wasn't it? And it's like saying, "You did good, Tom. Go ahead, do another one."
Essentially, yeah, that's what happened. It seemed like a fun thing to do, so we did it. You know, as I say, I write strictly for fun. As long as it stays fun, I'll continue to do it.
But you don't really have to go writing life insurance anymore if you didn't want to.
Because you have
a family, a company.
I never do life insurance. It's too morbid.
Oh.
I do fire and casualty. You can have a loss in fire and casualty insurance and not have to bury anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So now if somebody's house burns down, I build them a new house, which is a lot more fun. Handing somebody a check to repair the damage in his life is a lot more enjoyable than giving a check to a widow. But in any case, you know, what I'm doing now has changed my perspective to the extent that it's a little harder now to get excited about writing a homeowner's policy.
Well, I suppose when you're invited to speak before the Rotary or the Lions Club and so forth, you don't have to talk about insurance. You can go and talk about war and peace and the military and this sort of thing, right?
That's what they usually ask me about, you know.
Well, the last time we chatted, you told me that you were writing, co-authoring a book.
Yes.
And I believe you said at the time it was Larry Bond.
Yes.
And yet his name only appears in an author's note. Why is this?
Oh, that was a decision made here in New York by the folks at Putnam, and Larry ultimately agreed to it.
But what was his role in writing the book? What were your various responsibilities?
I don't know that we ever really figured out a division of labor. We mainly what we did was bat ideas back and forth continuously for about a year, and the book is the ultimate result of the ideas that circulated back and forth on the telephone.
How did you meet Larry Bond?
He advertised in the U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings for his war game Harpoon, and I thought, you can't go too far wrong for $10, so I ordered the thing.
Now, what was this again?
His war game Harpoon. It was advertised in Naval Institute Proceedings. That's the monthly journal of the Naval Institute Press. And I bought it and read it, and I was sufficiently impressed that I fired off a letter saying, hey, this is pretty good stuff. Excuse me. And he wrote back to me and said, thanks. I also said I thought there was a mistake in it. It turns out I was right. He had gotten some bum information. So
what was the game about?
Naval warfare. How modern weapons.
Computer game?
No. It's played with pencil and paper. Essentially the same sort of a game they play, say, at the Naval War College in Newport. It's two books. The first book is the rules, how things operate, how ships move, how weapons function. And the second book is a database. It lists ship classes by name and the equipment that's aboard each of them. So anyway, we started talking on the phone, and we got friendly enough that ultimately he became my son's godfather. And Tommy's first birthday in 1983, Larry was over the house, and he started Red October by this time had been finished, but it hadn't been edited or published yet. So we just sort of sat down in my living room after we cut the cake, and he started talking about one of his projects. He was going to call it Convoy 84, and what he wanted to do was examine the process and the difficulties of running convoys against modern weapons. You know, we hypothesized a central front war, a war in Germany between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. And to support that war, it's been estimated that we have to run 500 ships per month across the Atlantic Ocean to provide military supplies to support NATO. He wanted to see if that could really work or not. And he started talking, and I hit him with some ideas, and he hit me with some of his ideas. And after about an hour, I just said, well, you know, why don't we just write a book about it? So we shook hands on the deal, and that was that. We never really anticipated the degree of success Red October would have, and certainly we never anticipated hitting number one on the New York Times list with this one. We simply did it as something to do for fun.
Is he also a Marylander?
No, Larry lives in. He's originally from Minnesota, as he says, and
Minnesota.
Minnesota, and now he lives in Virginia.
So you were within commuting distance of each other.
Yeah, it's about a 90-minute drive, so we don't do it very often. Usually, we let our fingers do the walking.
So this collaboration, how did it work exactly? Did you get together on weekends or weekdays or on the phone mostly, or mail your manuscripts back and forth? Or
we did it with computer disks, as a matter of fact. We mailed them back and forth. How did it work? God, there's a question. The same thing happened with this as happened with Red October. It all kind of turns into a blur. You know you've done it, but you don't know how you've done it. You know, the important thing is we had a good deal of fun doing it, and we're still friends. You know, I don't think there's anything more destructive to a friendship than trying to co-author a book, and despite that fact, we ended up we can still talk to each other.
Well, it was Putnam's decision to capitalize on the success of The Hunt for Red October by using your name only, but I wonder now that the book is on the bestseller list, Larry is saying, hey, I wonder why I shouldn't have cashed in and had my name on that front cover.
Oh, he's doing all right.
You have incredible detail about not only weapons, but things like Soviet energy production. Now, are these figures readily available?
Specific publication that I used as a source on that is a CIA pub called the USSR Energy Atlas, and it's available from anybody who wants to buy it from the government printing office.
Mm-hmm. I jotted down some of the organizations that fulfill major functions in the book, ASWMAD. I guess you actually pronounce them by names, don't you? ASROC, SIC, DFAR.
No, ASW is said ASW. MAD is called MAD.
Yeah, I think ASW would be hard to pronounce. ASWA. I guess you'd have to say ASWA or something.
What's that? Oh, well,
ASW.
This means anti-submarine warfare.
Saclant.
Saclant. Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic.
Stavka.
Stavka. Yeah, that's a Russian. Actually, it's a word, not an acronym. And the way the Russians work their language is kind of a contraction. It just means they're general staff.
How do you remember what all that alphabet stands for?
Oh, you just get used to it. It's if you have to excuse me. If you have to deal with it every day, it becomes part of the territory.
So why don't you put a glossary at the end for guys who would read it once and forget what it means?
I'm afraid you have to talk to my editor about that.
The technology involved in this war of the future, you have all sorts of phenomenal weapons, infrared guided missiles and various radars and sonars and things like that. Do we really have these weapons available to us now?
Everything in the book is real.
We can use them now?
Yes. Everything in the book, one of the things I did with Red October and also with Red Storm is we use equipment that's already out there and we use it in the way for which it is designed to be used. Our objective in doing this was to display the capabilities as closely as possible, and I think we've done just that.
That's scary, isn't it? Because most of these weapons have never really been tested in actual warfare.
Well, it depends on what you mean by tested. They do fire off exercises.
In actual warfare, though, we haven't used them, have we?
Well, you want to go out? You want us to go out and try?
No, I don't. But that's what's scary about it, because the sophistication of these weapons, it seems so impersonal that the whole nature and complexion of war is has to change. Well, we thought Vietnam was an impersonal war, perhaps, but the war that you depict in Red Storm Rising, I mean, it's terrible. All of a sudden, things come out of head towards you from out of nowhere, and you're dead, and it's, I mean, I guess there were things like that in the Second World War, Big Bertha and weapons like that, but still, isn't this a really scary development?
Well, fundamental truth we have here is that, you know, there aren't any nice ways to kill people. I just purchased the video cassette of Spartacus, and which depicts the, you know, the Roman legions and all that stuff. That's a lot more personal, but I don't think it's a heck of a lot more attractive.
No, but it seems to be, there seems to be less of mass killing.
Are you kidding? You gotta read Caesar's Gallic Wars about what he did to the Helvetii supposedly you killed 250,000 people in one day.
Yeah.
I mean, that was second year Latin for me in high school.
Okay. It's kind of like the Red Storm Rising is kind of like a longest day, isn't it? Set in the future where you have taken various aspects of the war and I guess the longest day was about a specific battle, but it's formatted much the same, isn't it? Did you get some clue from that?
I read that book some years ago, but the thought of copying it never really entered my mind. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to compare myself. That's Cornelius Ryan, as I recall. I wouldn't want to compare myself with him. He's too good a writer.
The book reads almost like a computer game in some respects because it's a matter of seeking and destroying. One by one, ships go down and submarines go up and this sort of thing.
Well, search and destroy, seek out and destroy is, that phrase has been in naval parlance for hundreds of years. And that's exactly what the mission of a Navy ship is, to seek out and destroy the enemy.
There was never an actual declaration of war in Red Storm Rising, was there?
Yeah, I'm glad somebody finally noticed that. That's correct. Yeah.
Why? Did you have to have that for two sides to fight? I guess
I
guess I think back.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, most of the wars that the United States has been involved in this century were undeclared. So, and one of the advantages to not declaring war in this particular case, although it never really came into play, is that maybe this way we would keep our embassy open in Moscow and they'd keep their embassy open in the United States, and that might be a stabilizing factor for preventing the exchange of nuclear weapons.
Well, as I think back, the Reagan administration has staged a couple of major attacks in the past year or so. One, an invasion of Grenada, invading another country, and most recently bombing another country, Libya. And in either case, did the Congress declare war or give the president the green light to do that? I just wonder what kind of powers...
First of all, the Congress doesn't have to give the president the green light to do something like this. The Constitution...
Declare war, in effect, unilaterally?
The Constitution makes the president of the United States commander-in-chief of the armed forces. I mean, that was written by James Madison and all the founding fathers. So he has the legal right to send the troops out and do whatever he thinks is appropriate.
Now, even invading another country?
Certainly.
Without the will of the people?
Such wonderful liberal folks as Woodrow Wilson did exactly the same thing. Franklin D. Roosevelt did the same thing. Harry Truman did the same thing. This is not unusual. As a matter of fact, there's much more precedent for doing it that way than it is to declare war, if you examine American history.
I don't know. I thought we were a democracy, and the people had to have some sort of input before a president in the White House decides to attack another country unilaterally.
Well, it's never been the history in the history of the United States. It just simply doesn't work out that way. We are a democracy insofar as we elect our representatives to operate for us. I think if we'd held a plebiscite on whether or not we should have bombed Libya or whether or not we should have invaded Grenada, it is reasonable to assume that since the American people supported both actions, they would have voted in favor. However, in a modern world, you don't have time to get a Gallup poll if you have to go in and take military action. For one thing, it may just tip off the other guy that we're coming, which would probably incur greater casualties for our forces.
Well, Tom,
the president is empowered by the Constitution to act on behalf of us and to protect American lives and property. That's his mission. His mission takes precedence over some of the other things that happen. Are we supposed to follow this theoretical set of rules and allow people to die?
Well, Tom, you depict in the Kremlin the goings-on among the various Soviet officials who people are off the wall. And you wonder how these people can be allowed to make decisions that cause so much death and carnage. Mm-hmm. You have a great deal of faith in the people occupying our current White House to allow them to do the same thing, in effect, that the Russians do in your book.
Well, if you're asking me if I'd rather be governed by the Soviet Politburo over the President of the United States, I think I'd opt for the President of the United States because he was freely elected by the people. That is a distinction that the members of the Soviet Politburo do not have, as at least the last time I checked, the Soviet Union was not a democracy. The Soviets are essentially a feudal society run by a collection of dukes, except they don't call themselves dukes. They call themselves ministers and party secretaries. And their system does not militate toward toward moderation in the same way that our system does.
I noticed that. I don't know how accurate this is, but I assume there's a degree of accuracy. The Russians seem to haul off generals and lower officers and have them shot at will. There's one point where the commander of the Soviet troops on Iceland seeks to surrender, and one defense official in the Kremlin says, have that man arrested and also arrest the family of that traitor. And I just can't imagine this country doing something like that.
But we don't do things like that because we have what's called due process of law. The Soviets don't have that handicap on their legal system. If they decide to shoot somebody, they just go out and shoot them. Fortunately, we have a handicap called due process. And there's ample precedent for that, by the way. If you Stalin ordered the execution of approximately 70% of Soviet army officers between 1937 and 1939. And when the Germans invaded Russia in 1941, a lot of generals got taken out permanently in the first week of the war, including the commander-in-chief of the Soviet Air Force.
The Russian strategy in preserving and taking control of these oil fields in the Middle East was to create a diversion by attacking NATO or seeking a ruse to attack West Germany bomb that was planted in the Kremlin. But I just wonder, how could they conceivably think that they could get away with something like that? Because they would know that their hands would be completely full trying to fight the NATO troops. And in fact, in the book, they never got around to taking effort to get those oil fields.
Well, turn the clock back to 1941. What reasonable facts do the Japanese have to suspect that they could attack us and win? When Hitler invaded Russia in June of 1941, he thought he was going to win. He was wrong. You can make a very good case for saying that the decision the country makes to go to war, I mean full-scale war as opposed to the Grenada operation or the Libyan bombing, an actual go-to-war decision is probably never a completely rational decision, speaking philosophically. And if you look at the major wars in this century, I think you'll find that in the great majority of cases that the country that started the war lost.
You don't think the Russians are so far off the wall that they might do something like that, do you?
Given the preconditions of our scenario, yes. And there's historical precedent for that, too. As I said earlier, we faced the Russians with essentially the same strategic situation the Japanese faced in 1941. Mm. They decided to go to war, and it was a mistake.
I'd always perceived the Russians as being stronger than ourselves because it would seem to me that they have devoted more of their money and their manpower into armaments and this sort of thing. But in your book, you show very explicitly that the NATO people have held their own very, very well. Is this something that you believe? Could we win a war against the Russians?
I think the book, as we wrote it, reasonably... Or depicts the capabilities of both sides with reasonable accuracy. The Russians certainly are formidable. They have lots of tanks and lots of guns and lots of people carrying rifles. At the same time, you may want to remember that the United States Army, the United States Navy, the U.S. Marines, the Air Force, and all our allies are also fairly formidable people who also have lots of guns and tanks and rifles to carry. And then we don't train our people to lose, we train them to win.
I've always perceived the Russians as being somewhat inept. I don't know why this is. It may be because in following some aspects of their space program, where they've had a lot of, they made a lot of mistakes and had a lot of deaths that they don't talk about. But perhaps this goes back to this feudal approach that the Soviets seem to have toward themselves and the world. I just wonder if a society like that allows for anything other than ineptness in the long run.
Well, obviously the system also rewards performance. If you do a particularly good job, you're going to get promoted. One of the advantages the Soviet system has over ours, but of course only on a short-term basis because ultimately it'll catch up with you, is they have politically they have the ability to focus on a specific problem and pour a lot of resources into that one problem. As a result, their space program, for example, works a lot better than the rest of their economy. And similarly, their military system works better than their economy as a whole. The cost of that, of course, is a country that can't feed itself. They're building tanks instead of tractors, and they can't grow enough wheat, so we have to sell them wheat. It's a mistake to underestimate the Russians. It is also a mistake to overestimate them. They do have their limitations, and their limitations really stem from their political system. The political system they have over there is one of central control. The Politburo, the Dukes I talked about earlier, really try to run everything from a central locus in Moscow, and do not allow people to have the individual initiative that, for example, you have in America. One of the results of that is that you're stifling initiative. People are always, instead of people thinking about what they can do right now to make things better, they wait for instructions from above. Ultimately, that's going to catch up with you.
They ran out of vodka recently, too, but I guess that was...
That was a deliberate political decision by Mikhail Gorbachev, I believe, because he's trying to cut down alcoholism.
It's probably one of their worst, too. They've got to get away from it all somehow, and I guess vodka is one way of doing it. The sides in the Red Storm Rising avoided using chemical and nuclear warfare, although some of the... Soviet officials at the end were seeking to do that. Can this really be avoided? Isn't it almost inevitable that a war is going to escalate, even a limited war of this nature, so that these...
If you think that sort of thing is inevitable, you're going to make it inevitable. Mm-hmm. The whole point of having conventional arms is to prevent the use of nuclear weapons. If our conventional forces, the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, with their the conventional arms, tanks, guns, and airplanes, if they can perform the mission without resorting to nuclear weapons, it's so much the better for everybody. Because it's my personal opinion that if people start using nuclear weapons, it's going to get habit forming real fast, and it just might get out of control. So it is very much in our interest to keep the war at a conventional level. I do think we have the ability to do that, but it's a very slim margin.
The part of the book I liked best was the part that took place, it's sprinkled throughout the book, took place in Iceland. I thought that was quite interesting, and that led me to wonder about how you organized the book. Did you write these individual episodes and then cut them and to insert them, or what? I mean, it's almost impossible, it seemed to me, to sit down there chapter by chapter and go from one to another, but how did you do that structurally?
I just did it. I'd carry a scene to a conclusion and start another scene. What I tried to do was keep in my mind what all the different characters are doing. But I found, found it for myself a lot more interesting and a lot more fun to do it that way. I'm not really well enough organized to plot it all out ahead of time. I'd just rather sit down at the keyboard and let it happen.
Well, it's certainly a cliffhanger, and obviously it hasn't been out very long, but already you can see that the people are interested in it, and this is something that touches us all, and that's this fear of war is always in the backs of our minds that it could happen, and I hope it never does. But if it does happen, I hope it turns out the way it turns out in Red Storm Rising. But I won't say that on the air, because I don't think the reader wants to know how the war is going to end until he reads the book.
One of the things you want to keep in mind is that the reason we have a military, the reason we have the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines is to keep a war from happening. And if you talk to the people in uniform, they will tell you exactly that. If they do their job right, they will prevent a war from happening.
Have you ever regretted not being part of the military? It seems to have occupied so much of your life now as a civilian.
I think everybody should serve his time in one way or another. I was prevented from doing so by my eyesight, but maybe it's just as well. Things seem to have a way of working out for the best.
Well, you've certainly made up for it by giving us a lot of things to think about in terms of war and peace. And Tom Clancy, thank you very much for coming back and talking to me, and congratulations on the initial success of Red Storm Rising.
Thank you, sir.